Kia ora, I'm Graham. Welcome to episode 8 of The Good Oil, Conversations with Aotearoa Painters. In this episode, I visit John Walsh in his Wellington home and studio to sit by the fire and drink tea and talk about his practice. John is Aitanga, Hauiti and New Zealand Irish descent. His work is held in numerous public and private collections, including Te Papa and the Sargent Gallery Collection. He has exhibited widely, including at City Gallery in Wellington, Auckland Art Gallery Toi o Tamaki, at the Dales Art Museum in Lower Hutt, and Pataka Art and Museum in Porirua. He is represented by Gow Langsford in Auckland, Paul Nash Gallery in Gisborne, Page Galleries in Wellington, the Division Gallery in Picton, and the Central Art Gallery in Christchurch. In this episode, you'll hear John talk about how painting portraits of his community elders allowed him an unexpected opportunity to learn about his whakapapa, how he learned more about what paint can do from house paint and painting houses than he did at art school, the creative license he applies to mythologies to bridge cultural gaps, his occupation of the Twilight Zone, the deliberate variation of surface of a support he prepares to paint on, and how he is an intuitive abstract painter, accidentally making representational paintings. We started by talking about his childhood growing up in Tolaga Bay.
I grew up in Uawa, Tolaga Bay, up on the east coast, 50 k's north of Gisborne, in an idyllic environment it was in those days. I didn't know anything else. It was a community of some around 1,000 people. That's with the greater district as well. We had friends and whānau coming in from the stations up the back, and we had grandfather on a farm where we had to go and kill the odd mutton as a 12-year-old, so I was, like you, I think, country boy.
Yeah. Yeah, so quite a rural community.
Absolutely. We have the wharf in Tolaga Bay, which was built for the wool industry. And, the lighters coming in from out at sea, and half a mile long wharf that... the wool was sent out on these big railway trucks. It's all had it now, but
and first experiences of art then in that community as well.
There wasn't so much art per se, because we didn't have an art gallery or anything like that. We had no experience of contemporary art as a kid growing up. But I was a kid, I was one of those kids who could draw, and it was just natural. We'd sit around in the playtime at primary school, and there'd be dueling pencils, to mimic war comics and, whatever was on our mind.
So did you have a sense then that there might have been some talent?
Oh, absolutely. I was the best drawer in the group. Kingi Maitai and I were, we were the dueling pencils. It was wonderful. Yeah, no, but what that meant was totally obscure. I didn't know where it was going to lead to, and no one ever thought that being able to draw could lead you anywhere. It was just one of those tricks.
Because this is... 1950s, 60s.
Really, I became conscious.
Right, but yeah. But long before there was any, established art market or in New Zealand.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So establishing career then, you didn't exactly leave school and become a fine artist immediately.
No. There's one story, though, that, we had a dump in Tolaga Bay, refuge tip.
Oh, yeah.
And it was the great engineers of the time were filling in the last of the swamp that down by the river mouth. It was utterly stupid, but it was a great dump. And I was a townie. I lived in the town opposite, in a house opposite the pub, the Tolliga Bay Inn. And so I was more of a townie than most townies in a lot of ways, because I was aware of everything that was going on in the town, who was knocking who and who, you know, who was gaining and losing. I was aware of it all.
Even as a kid?
As a kid.
Yeah.
I looked out across our hedge from my bedroom at the pub, at the main entrance to the pub. My marble bag was as big as anyone's.
Right, the pub main centre of commerce.
It was at the time, yeah. More than the marae or anything. Any, you know, it would all go on there. I grew up just at the end of the 6 o'clock swill and all of that sort of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. So saw it all going on in front of you.
Yeah. Yeah. But that dump, which was just down the way from me, it was a hunting ground
For
townies, you know, like us, you know, a few of us. It was the stench. The local butcher used to dump all of his offal down. It was disgusting. But there was amazing treasure to be had. And, I mean, we weren't allowed to go down there. There was no health and safety in those days.
All the more reason to go, obviously.
Yeah, absolutely. We were kicked out if we were caught. But one time when I was russicking around, I found this throw-out, an old suitcase that someone had cleaned out, possibly someone had died, and, you know, an old person. And in it, I found these remarkable, old, weathered notebooks, sketch pads. And they were from a World War II soldier.
Wow.
Who had served. He was probably a relation of mine. And I didn't know, there was nothing to identify him. But I was only about 11 or 12, something like that. It was before I went to high school. And I remember poring through these pads and seeing all of these drawings, beautifully crafted, like this. I could draw, but that was sort of like the first time I really felt like I was looking at real art.
In the local dump.
Yeah.
How extraordinary.
Yeah, it was.
So was that the first time you felt like you were encountering something other?
Huge. That's right.
Hmm.
I ferreted them home and treasured them for years. And you know, when I went away, eventually went away to boarding school, like a year or so after that, and into Gisborne. And then after that, I went off to art school. And when I came back, I went hunting for those notebooks, but my mum had cleaned up. I could never find them again.
So gone forever?
Yeah.
And you've no idea to this day whose work
they were? No. I would have, at that point, I was conscious enough to be able to hunt them down. But as a kid, I just had these in my hand.
But then no going, like presumably you're still sketching, presumably not painting at a young age, but
yes,
beginning to play with paints at a young age.
We did. There was one incident where I think it was Mrs. Cranswick, and anyone from Tolliga will know Mrs. Cranswick. Great teacher.
Teacher, yeah.
Yeah, she took us down to the river mouth with a bunch of paints. And she just set us up and said, there you are, paint what you see. And there were these wonderful islands out off the Horseshoe Bay that Tolliga Bay is. And I just sat there and I painted these. That was my first. I could draw, but here I was drawing with paint, you know what I mean? Making that connection.
And that felt really different than a pencil.
It was huge for me.
How did it, do you remember how it felt different?
I just, yes, I felt that this was like a huge step. Somehow I'd gained some power and some knowledge and skill level, all of those things were sort of like a eureka moment. And we took them back to the class there, and I remember it disappeared. I think a girl that I was fancying at the time decided that she could have it.
I hope she's still cherishing it somewhere.
Yeah. So anyway, I mean, that's sort of like how it all began. You know, there was no art in our family as such. My mother and father were both good with their hands, craftspeople, and you know, they were not tied to any one industry in a small town like Tolaga. We were jack of all trades, and
but Mrs. Cranswick, she was a guiding hand of sorts.
At that point, she was, yeah. But you know, there was this other thing. My Māori culture was always there as well, and it was hard to make that connect because it wasn't sort of taught as such. It was just there around us. We'd go to the marae and you'd be just enveloped by the carvings of the place, and so that was always there, and it was a totally different type of art to my ability to draw in the playground,
but it clearly stuck.
And the stories, you know, you'd sit around and there would be always stories in the marae. And so those somehow knitted in there, but not in a practical way that I could use in my work, but they were knitted in there somehow.
You spent your first few years painting portraits, right, as almost a pragmatic solution of what would be a foothold as an artist?
Yeah. I went through high school and didn't amount to, you know, high school is high school, and I managed to get into art school from there. All the males in my family are afflicted with a sort of dyslexia, and I mean, I've taught myself to read and I'm completely competent now, but I'm a slower reader. And it's plagued me all through my, you know, learning life. And at art school, the practicals were just a walk in the park, but making sense of the art history and getting those papers completed was a real test. And I eventually just faded out. I mean, it wasn't just that. I was young and restless anyway, and I quit art school in the second year and came back to Tolaga Bay.
Yeah, so just to give that a little more context for listeners, Ilam at University of Canterbury for a couple of years, but as you say, 2 years in.
A year and a bit.
So after a year and a bit, you just thought, well, the practical's great, but it just doesn't work for me. Is that the reason that you left Ilam?
And, I had this idyllic idea of art. And, growing up in that small community, it was completely abstract to what was going on at art school at the time. I just wasn't interested in
what was being taught and the theory?
In what was being taught. And no, it's not the theory. I loved the theory. Oh. Don't get me wrong. Oh. I never shied away from it. I was just slow at getting through exams. And I couldn't...
It
was a nightmare.
The dyslexia
not
helping.
It was a nightmare. But no, the whole scene was... I don't know, too much of a country boy or something. I just found it not palatable. You know, a bunch of important people climbing over each other. Nothing to do with the art as such. And so what that, hey, you know, they were, and most people were just more interested in pulling the right face and at the right people. And that was...
So you ended up then being self-taught.
I went home and, you know, after moping about for a while doing other crazy things, I went home and I decided to pick up... The funny thing was my art teacher at high school had given me some paints one sort of long weekend to take home. And our hairdresser in Tolaga Bay had these beautiful portraits of a great aunt of mine, Nanny Few Maitai. She was the last queer moko in the district. And he said, "Here, paint her." And so I took that home and I painted. I started painting that. And this was at high school. And after art school, when I came back, that was still there. Sort of just the beginning, you know, I was into it, but it was...
Unresolved.
Unresolved. So I just went there. And it may have taken me 3 months to complete that painting. But I did teach myself fundamentals of making paintwork. Another big part of that was that my father was, one of his many jobs, was he was a house painter, and I would go out and help him in school holidays and whenever. And the funny thing is I learned more about what paint can do from those experiences than I did from art school.
About the material and how it behaves.
What paint can do if you thin it, you know, the extent that you can thin it, what marks you can make with these house painting brushes, you know, the control you can have, all of that sort of thing. Preparation of surface, which is huge for what I do today, is all I got from there.
Well, because especially, one of the surfaces you like working on is board. So is that almost a nod to house painting?
It is a nod to house painting. Not only board, it's even on canvas. There's a specific a surface that I like to work on that's still got a bit of bite to it, but it's sealed. The paint, the oil is not going to be absorbed too much into the ground. And there's a knack to getting a surface like that. And it's house paint that does it for me.
That's probably a good point to come back to, moving from portraits to... I suppose the work that we recognise being John Walsh now, and it's so different from what were quite realist portraits that you were painting originally.
Yeah.
So that change over the course of, I don't know, how long and why did you move to, you know, as I say, what we recognise as John Walsh paintings now? Because they're quite different.
Yeah. My mum had a home cookery shop in Tolaga Bay, and when I finished a painting... I would be in there helping my mum make pies and serve in the shop and whatever. And I'd have these portraits up on the wall behind there. And, you know, in a small community, there were handsome old people sitting on the form outside in their best, smiling at me. And so that was an easy thing to keep going.
Like a ready line of subjects.
And it was a wonderful thing to do. It was, for me, it was... you know, to learning about my whakapapa and all of their stories from, you know, generations ago.
From sitting with the subject.
Yeah. You know, the older they got, they would nod off. It was impossible half the time. But it was still a wonderful thing, and I may have done it for 3 years. And eventually I approached the marae, one of our marae, and with an idea to do a huge painting, 60 foot long it was in the end, and 12 foot tall. And I wanted to get away from my brushes with three hairs in them and start swinging with a house painting brush that I'd use with my dad.
And the work you're talking about is Portrait of Uawa Tolaga Bay.
That's right, yeah.
Which ended up attracting some controversy, right?
It did.
Talk us through that controversy.
So I I approached the Marae elders with this idea, and you know, they were all happy with the portraits I was doing and thought it was a great idea. And so we set up and got funding through under their umbrella, through MASPAC, as it was in those days, the Arts Council, and Māori Affairs. I mean, it was only enough for materials, basically, and I had to be put on a PEP scheme. But anyway, I flew into it. The thing is, I didn't know what it was going to be. I just wanted to do it. I just wanted to break out of this tight portraiture and into something grander that I had visions of from art school and watching the world of art, but I didn't know where it was going to. It was a big adventure that I was heading into. And the only thing I had in my head was the first panel of my young surfing mate standing next to a carving from the Marae and looking into the rest of the 60 metres of painting, wondering about his life. That was the concept for the painting. And it developed from there, and it developed into all sorts of crazy and unusual things. So relationships between different Marae and Māori Pākehā relationships, and this shop and that shop, and the different politics that was going on in the district. I put it all in there and
almost fun. Naively.
No, well,
naively in the context of you weren't expecting the controversy.
Oh, absolutely. Completely naive to that. Completely. But it was, what an adventure. What an adventure to do, to create this visual sort of talking community. And a lot of the young people were coming over. I set up a ping pong table, and it was in the big old shed that was attached to the wharf that all of the wool bales were. It was a beautiful old shed with lanolin all the way through the wood and the floors. And anyway, it was a great, great venue. And
sounds like the best studio you've ever had.
Probably. And halfway through it, the Māori committee came over and stood in front of it and thought, whoa, this is not traditional. This is not even just portraiture. This is something else. I don't know if we can cope with this on the Marae.
We've created a monster.
Yeah, it was just, they weren't saying a monster. It wasn't like that at that point. It was just saying maybe it should go onto into the community someplace. And at that point, talk among all the young people and just sort of got out of hand. The newspaper came in because it was such a big thing. Massive articles. I was shooting my silly mouth off. And then it was, when I just shut down on it. I finished the work. It went into storage. It blew up into something unpleasant. And we were in town with a young family, and it was really just time to move on. So,
interesting intersection, though, because it sounds like at a time like either perhaps unintentionally, you were busy doing what lots of Māori artists were doing, which was redefining what Māori art is.
Mm.
Did you ever sense that you were doing that, or was it quite accidental? And it sounds like, because it sounds
no,
like
no, not
really...
not initially. I had no clue about that. Toward the end of it, in 1973, 1974, 1975, I started being drawn into Ngā Puna Waihanga. I don't know if you heard of them, but this was a Māori artist and writers who put on a hui every year at a different marae. It was the most wonderful thing. And that is where I made that connection with what I was as a painter and as a young artist and my culture. That's where it bedded in.
So that must have come along like Napuna Waihanga must have come along at just the right time for you, because you would have been in your early 20s at the inception of Napuna Waihanga. So 1973, I think, was the, the organisation was formed.
That's right.
Perfect timing for you.
It was. It was. And my mate John Hovell, who was another artist living up in Te Araroa, he was a, you know, living on the coast and being an artist was no easy thing. He was a shearer most, you know, when, and at the end of the shearing run, he would get in his great old Mercedes car, come down to Tolaga Bay, pick me up, and I would drive so he could sleep, and we would truck off to the, wherever the marae, wherever the hui was, and for 3 days, and we would just be engrossed in the whole thing. Writers, playwrights, poets, painters, sculptors.
So it sounded like that experience is one that, that made you sit back and go, bloody hell, there's something I can really climb into here, even if it's not a full-time job. There's inspiration there.
Yeah, yeah. More than art school ever gave me.
Did that make you look at marae differently as well?
It was all just evolving, and you know, I wasn't a... none of my philosophies that are quite strong now were, you know, well-formed in those days. After the mural, we moved to Gisborne. Oh, no, I started getting offered to do restoration work on marae, like rongotai. Rongopai, sorry, and out of Gisborne, which was Te Kōti's, a house built for Te Kōti while he was on the run.
That's quite a history.
It was a wonderful, wonderful experience to go there. The house was dilapidated, and marae committee and conservation movement, you know, led by Cliff Whiting and the Arts Council set us up there to go and do this restoration on these amazing works that were done with natural pigments and shark oils, and unbelievable.
And that experience must have bled into work now. You have a sense that you've carried that forward.
Yeah, all of these things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That said, from those beginnings in Tolaga Bay, you've ended up with a pretty flash CV. So ended up moving to Wellington to take up the role as Te Papa Curator for Contemporary Māori Art.
Yeah.
Just, you know, one of claims to fames. I mean, there's a couple of other things I'll ask about in a moment, but, you know, various teaching roles as well. But that role at Te Papa, that must have also broadened horizons. I'm assuming you're encountering a lot of work you hadn't seen before and that you were looking at a lot more closely.
Yeah.
Both as artist and as curator.
Yeah. So there was a gap between all of those experiences with marae back in Tolaga. You know, I went did some teaching in Gisborne. I went to sea after the Polytech in Gisborne had a change of focus, and I felt there was, you know, I couldn't stay. So I went to sea in a deep-sea Japanese trawler for a year. And
quite the experience, I assume?
That was, you know, bigger than art school.
Right, yes.
Real life, I think, has really impacted me hugely. These, you know, working, like playing ping pong non-stop. This is how I equate fishing, you know, those fishing trips, for 6 hours. 6 hours on, 6 hours off, for 3 months, 2 to 3 months. You were a zombie, but you've, you know, you did it. Yeah, and with a group of people who are in the same state of mind, and with that harsh, harsh, and you know, fishing is not an easy gig. It was wonderful. It was wonderful.
So that comes through in the work as well?
Absolutely, yes. You know, when I went into this art game, when I left Te Papa, finally, we can get back to Papa, but when I left it, I just, in my own being, said to myself, if I can't make it in this arena, this art world, on my own strengths, you know, so be it. I wasn't going to start, as I had witnessed in Te Papa, a whole lot of artists constantly applying for grants, and that was, I just didn't think that was, you know, something that I wanted to do. There's so much of your time and energy is like teaching. You don't, you know, if you're going to be an artist, for Christ's sake. And so I didn't want to do that. I went in there and made
When you say, if you're going to be an artist, you mean climb into your work, pile into it.
Yes.
And if it feels like it's working.
The strength of what you make will make your life.
Mm.
Yeah.
So that time at Te Papa, them encountering work, as I say, I assume there was an element there of, you know, all of a sudden being exposed to a lot of work you hadn't seen before. Mm. So
after being at sea, I had a job at the museum in Gisborne. A job came up there. So that was my introduction to museums, really. I mean, I had been exhibiting in the museum in Gisborne when I was teaching. A group of friends and I set up an arts co-op. We called it the Flying Moor. and we would gather and have these wild exhibitions and drink and smoke pot, and it was wonderful.
Yeah.
And eventually this job came up at the museum, that exhibitions officer. And I'd just come back from out at sea. And that was a great experience, but not something you want to spend 40 years at. So I managed to get that job, and the director was an astronomer, luckily, and he just let me have a full rein. And as an exhibitions officer, I wrote the program, bringing in different community groups, the Samoan community, bringing in different marae projects from up and down the East Coast. It was fantastic, you know, because I had a free rein.
Yeah.
He would, unless it was completely nuts, he would just let me go.
Well, it sounds like occasionally it was completely nuts.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
But, I mean, there wasn't a great budget, but I was energetic. You know, we would make, we combined museum and artistic shows, and I created these big, like, inside the gallery, I built hills and fortifications and tunnels, and we put artifacts and artworks in amongst it. And then that's when Te Papa advertised for this position of curator of contemporary Maori art, because, they needed Maori to do it. And I put my hand up, and through my connections with Ngā Puna Wahanga, I got the job. So,
good experience.
You know, it was a wonderful experience on many levels, in that I got to see all of the art.
Mm.
I got to meet all of the artists. I got to meet everyone who was doing anything in the art world, all the dealers, the curators, the collectors. I understood the business. I got a handle on the whole thing. The terrible side of it was that the internal politics at Te Papa was an absolute nightmare.
Yeah, large organisation, almost unavoidable.
Yeah, and fairly early on the piece, it was evident that my sensibilities were not what they wanted. that's being polite.
Right.
And I was basically given a window seat. I don't know if you understand that.
I do. Yeah.
Hoping that I'd eventually wander off into the wonderful view.
Which you did. You wandered off into the view of your own practice.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But, you know, they had lured me down here with my young family of four.
Mm.
We sold our little cottage in Gisborne for not much to buy a house in Wellington. We were under the pump.
Mm.
And I couldn't just leave Te Papa straight away. So I carried on my own practice And eventually, galleries and dealers started to invite me to show, and then eventually my little waka was sailing as well as the big waka and I just stepped off. It wasn't such a huge break.
So it's easy to step into your own practice.
Yeah.
And then first solo exhibition at the age of 40, so a little older probably than most artists these days.
Mm.
How was that experience? Nerve-wracking, or were you pretty comfortable by then because of how long you've been painting?
It was sort of misleading, that comment, because it was my first solo exhibition in Wellington.
Mm.
You know, I had a hugely active and vibrant practice up on the East Coast with my mates. It was under the radar of the art world.
Yeah.
But I was not unfamiliar with exhibiting and...
So you were pretty easy with that show then?
Easy.
Yeah.
Easy. And the thing is, that work that I was doing back then, it was venting my frustrations with the arts bureaucracy.
Mm.
It was doing little things like, I don't know if you've seen any of those works from back then, but quite pointed.
And yeah.
I was dragged in front of the hierarchy at Te Papa and quizzed about what I was doing, and some wanted to sack me on the spot, and others thought it was a very good thing to do. And the critics out in the real world loved it.
Yeah.
And so it was alive. It was very lively, and it was good for me, and it was great, really.
As you say, allowed you to step into your own waka.
Yeah.
And
how's your tea?
My tea's? Yeah? My tea's all right. Do you want a top up?
I'll
take a top up.
It's cooled off a little, but I think that makes it just as nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, happily. Oh, and maybe steeped a little more as well.
Exactly,
eh?
Yeah.
Great.
Shall I put another log on while we're having a break?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, it brings us to principles or ethos of work. Mm. And there's a few specific words that come to mind for me looking at your work. So whakapapa, you've already mentioned.
Yeah.
Whenua, certainly.
Yes.
Colonisation, and it feels like increasingly capitalism, or at least in the sense the impact that capitalism is increasingly having on whenua. Yeah. And all of those four elements, you know, inexplicably entwined, right?
Yes.
So I suppose I wanted to start by talking about, or separating them out a little bit, and talking about whakapapa and whenua, because those two especially are really entwined in the Māori world, and certainly it seems like in your work.
Yeah.
Is that a reasonable read of work?
Yeah. They are intertwined with everything else that is happening in life. You know, four kids, you know, five moko, you know, the dog, you know, the garden, you know, all of those things are intertwined.
Mm. Although that's at a very personal level for you, those elements you've just mentioned, you must look a little broader as well to the rest of, as I say, whakapapa, genealogy, you know, where you come from.
Yeah. The funny thing is, though, to be a painter, it's a solitary gig. You know, the people who are very up with their whakapapa, they couldn't be painters. They are on the marae, they are at every hui and tangi. I couldn't do that. It's just not my makeup.
Mm.
And this suits me, that suits them. I am aware and deeply interested in all of those things, but I'm not that person.
Well, that interest certainly seems to come through where there's it seems like almost a blend of Māori mythology, perhaps with whakapapa, and whenua perhaps as well. So is that how you bring yourself closer to it?
You know, it's not so much, I don't use specific mythologies. I use the overall wairua and Māori of it. that's where I go. I go for the heart of it. And I always like to take that into any issue that I want to, you know, talk about. I present, you know, the heart of the land hurting in a mix, or things like that.
Mm. So there's a fair bit of creative license, but still balanced with wanting to breathe new life into that mythology?
Yes, that's true. It always needs to be, you know, pushed forward. You know, there's New Zealand is there's a lot of racism here. I didn't really want to get into this, but it's constant. And and to keep presenting a bigger worldview, which is what Maori can present in a palatable way, that the, you know, can open doors for people who have just got a blank in front of them, a racist blank, who can't engage on any level, to try and get them in on it, on something beautiful and something that they do agree with.
So that element for you of exercising some soft power through creative license and mythology, and maybe reaching an audience that don't understand that as well as they might.
Absolutely.
Mm.
There's a strange old adage that most artists are socialists. This is some, I don't know if it is true or not, but this is what I like that, I like it. And that most people, you know, in the art world, like the dealers, the buyers, are capitalists. You know, they've got, it's the big money game for them.
Yeah.
And they've, I mean, there's degrees of that too. That's never cut and dry. People love what they're looking at. And for me, not wanting to put my hand out for government funding right from the start, I've always loved the idea of wooing my audience, not in a sadistic or stupid way, but I like them to look into my work and to think something catches them there, and then something else, and then something else, and their eye is wandering around, and their mind is wandering around with it, and they've been taken on this sort of unexpected journey into ideas and concepts that they're maybe not familiar with, or really needed to look at that to become more familiar with. I don't know. I'm just making the damn thing.
Yeah, but that probably brings us close to the role of Manaya in your work, or intermediaries of the spiritual and mortal world, right?
Yeah.
So it sounds like you're talking about, you know, that them as perfect subjects to include in paintings, given what you've just said about what you're trying to translate. So it seems like they play a really important role in work.
Yeah, yeah. I know. I like to, as much as anything, I like the challenge of putting a human torso on a fish.
Well, and there are centaurs.
A centaur, all of that.
Yeah.
And to make it convincing. You know, it's a lot of people do it, and it's easy to make it clunky, and to, you can do it in a... I love it when I can make it look elegant and sort of possible. And then there's the possibility of what they're on about.
So you use them as your own, there's creative license there, using those creations of yours to create those manaya or messengers to deliver communication and work.
Yeah.
In your own unique take on.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not specifically Māori. Mm. Or, you know, I'm more Irish than I am Māori. You know, I live in, you know, a city away from my papakāinga. But that's okay. I mean, I absorb it all. It's all fair game. And I reinterpret all of it to make the statements that, you know, that are pressing. And half the time I start a work without even knowing that that is the issue that's going to be pressing at the end of it.
Well, I suppose that raises another point around Māori art, inverted commas, and increasingly, and I mean this in a good way, with it, it's becoming a misnomer, i.e. there are great artists that happen to be Māori. Yes. Without necessarily using, you know, immediately recognised motif or...
Exactly.
So you feel like you play in that space a little bit.
Absolutely. Yeah, always have.
Mm.
Yeah. But the fact is, the marks that I like making in the sort of that dark twilight zone that I keep going back to in my work, it just... I mean, without even thinking about it, it has those connotations of my, you know, Māori heritage more than anything else. And the way I paint a figure, I don't copy figures anymore. They just fall off the brush, or an aspect falls off the brush, and I think, well, that's an eye. There's an eye there. What can I do? And then gradually I can tease it out so that that eye with it has a specific squint or a look to it, and I can tease out a character around that eye, and then as I keep going, and this all happens quite quick, it's a very sketchy drawing type of painting technique, but I can. This is just for me. I don't know, God knows what people see when they look at it, but yeah. For me, I'm chasing that character.
Mm.
And what is that character doing? Okay, and then I'm off on a journey in that painting.
You just mentioned Twilight Zone, which incredibly applicable when it comes to your work, but I think related to Twilight Zone, at least for me, when I look at your work, there's an incredibly strange thing you're doing with sense of time. You know, time looks like it's past, present, and future all at once in your work. And especially if I look at work, in fact, a specific one, forgive me, John, I'm going to forget the name of it, but for listeners, if you happen to be in Wellington, a favourite work of yours hangs in the QT Hotel, so part of the Chris Park Inn collection. And listeners, trust me, it's very easy just to walk into reception and find that painting. I recommend you go and have a look at it. But in that work, for example, and in lots of work, horizon or landscape seems to melt into something else, and it makes it look like time is really fluid. So are you quite conscious of that when you're working, that you're trying to present, you know, past, present, future?
Not necessarily, not in that order. To me, it's the process. I start. I don't know. It's a difficult process to explain a lot of the time. I start with washes and the thin oils on these grounds that I talked about earlier, which allows me to push back. And a lot of my earlier paintings, it's not so much now, but a lot of those ones after I'd quit portraiture, and there was never any white added. The white was always the ground that I pushed the paint back to.
Just making sure the washes were thin enough for it to come through.
Or that I could push the paint back with more tips or rags or, you know, fingers or whatever allowed me to make a mark. That it's all about the mark, Graham.
All right. Well, before we, because I'm going to come back to mark making and process.
Yeah.
But before we go on to that, so those other two words, colonization and capitalism, and they like colonization, I think it works probably in the last decade or so. So, you know, tall ships presumably a really strong representation of colonization. Obviously, everything that goes with it, and then that capitalism piece, more recent work, especially the impact on, you know, homeland for you, Tolaga Bay, and the forestry industry, seems to be something else that's becoming more prevalent in work. Is that the case, and that's the intention?
Absolutely. No, it's becoming far more pointed, especially with what that you called it, forestry. I can't, that word can't pass my lips. It's not. It's forestry is implies something wonderful. This is plantation pine on a corporate scale, which is just the nastiest thing that you could do on that very fragile geology up on the East Coast. And that industry, which was invited in after Cyclone Vola, which was back in the 87, has just destroyed that wonderful environment that I grew up in.
This is especially precious to you because childhood, it's whenua for where you grew up.
Yeah, no, it's and to see what's happening now up on the coast there, and what the whānau and the, you know, the whole of the East Coast is going through, where, you know, once beautiful rivers that were alive with, you know, I used to fish them, and they're now just reduced to muddy, stinking drains. Their life is gone, and unless you've I don't know, because I've lived through all of that and I understand all of those rivers and waterways, and it just is so, it's so wrong, you know. I just can't go on making baubles for rich people or whatever, you know, that's
a bit harsh.
Yeah, yeah, no. I just find I am compelled to make pointed art.
Yeah, I was going to ask, so there's a really, there's, you have obviously a clear sense of responsibility almost that you need to be making work about that subject.
Yeah. I mean, what else, what is our life for? You know, if you can't stand up when something is pricking you.
Yeah, so an opportunity for you to be able to exercise, you know, even if it's soft power with the work, an opportunity to be able to make a contribution or provide a perspective.
Exactly. I mean, I am not, I'm a politician. I'm not, you know, that person on the marae. I'm incapable of that. But I'm reaching a lot of people, and I know I am through the comments that I'm getting back from this work that I'm doing. So. I mean, it's not the only work that I'm doing. It's, you know, it's all, like I say, intertwined with everything that is, that is life. Patting the dog and...
all leads up in the work in some way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to, you know, go back to process and some of those technical elements. So how do you start a work? Is the, you know, there's a sense of conceptual idea to begin with, and is there a ready store of ideas that you're chipping away at?
There are a store of ideas, and then new ones pop up that really get me fired up. Or I have I see something or hear something, and I just get I work visually. I can see things, and, you know, I can see in my mind the idea of a painting. I never let that get too far ahead, because once the process starts, that idea can be completely gone by what happens on the canvas. But I often start off with an idea like that. And, you know, with the, as I talked about, the grounds that I put down, every ground still is never the same, and every time that I push my paints across it, there is a different texture. A texture, maybe it's in the weight of the paint and the thinners that I put on, but there's every time it's slightly different, and there's different possibilities.
So are you preparing canvases still yourself to make sure that you end up with that rough texture that you want?
Yeah.
So you're slapping gesso on raw canvas?
No, I get pre-gessoed, but then that's not enough. I have to sand and come back on until I get what I want.
But with an intention to actually rough it up a bit, as opposed to end up with a really smooth surface?
No, to sand off the rough surface and then apply my coats, because there's still fibres in the canvas that want to prick up when you put paints on. So I sand them back, I come back, and...
but then when you come to actually applying paint, so the painting, that's quite different every time, it sounds like, you're suggesting.
Yes, even though I think that I've got a surface that I've got this idea that I'm heading down this direction with, once I put the paint on, sometimes it's just quite different, and And so that idea is morphed into something else immediately. Immediately. I can pursue the idea, but already it's taken on different connotations because of the way the paint bites on the surface.
So it sounds like you're working with a lot of instinct, but born out of action. So that sounds like quite an important part of the creative process for you, especially in terms of texture and those thin washes and how much you want to bleed through.
It's totally abstract. You know, this is what confuses a lot of people, because what I end up with is something that's quite literal. Real. You're looking at something that's real, but really my process all the way through is very, very abstract.
You're an accidental representational painter,
John? Yeah. You know, you've recently interviewed Judy Miller.
Mm.
Well, those marks that she makes are how I paint. You know, my different surfaces, my different colours, different weights of paint and thinners create different marks. But I see things in them, and I don't want to leave it as the mark. I want to chase those things that I see in those marks. And
as a non-painter, that sounds like a composition nightmare.
Well, it's absolute freedom. You see, if you go into a painting with a set idea, well, that to me is basically the creative part of it done and dusted there. The rest of it is labour. It may be months of labour, but to me that's what I don't do. The whole thing is a growing, evolving process. I can be halfway through a painting and think that whole area out to the left is got no weight to it. There's nothing, there's not enough. And I can abstract a bolt of lightning coming right through the whole thing and then start building onto that.
That probably goes to another question I often ask painters, which is, how do you manage problems? You know, well, how much of painting is problem solving for you?
Yeah, well, you can see it. I mean, they're opportunities, aren't they? You know,
a far easier word to work with. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember when I was interviewing Bill Hammond, though. We had to go down and see Bill about something when I was in my DePuffer years.
Ah.
And I said to him, because I was painting, I was getting close to leaving DePuffer at that point, and I said to him, what do you do with works that are just not going good? And, you know, because at that point I was, after a couple of hours of flying into it, if I wasn't happy, I would often just wipe it out completely.
The terps come out.
The terps comes out, and I'd end up with that beautiful ground again that I could start again with.
Yeah.
But I've since learnt to there's aspects of, always aspects of a painting that, oh, I like that. So I put them away in my cupboard for years sometimes, and I come back to them and I think, wow, look at that. I know what to do with that now. When I asked Bill, you know, what do you do about that, Bill? And he said, well, I started this fucking thing, I'll finish it.
So he was determined to get it done as soon as he could. He wasn't going to put it in the cupboard.
No, he would never give up on them, basically.
Right.
Yeah, which was good, you know, wonderful for me. It's just, at that point.
Another question I, you know, often ask painters is, what keeps you painting?
You know, it's easy for me in a lot of ways because it's, I don't go into a painting with a set idea.
Mm.
I start moving paint, and the whole thing is just an absolute adventure. I mean, that's enough to keep you going, isn't it? And the fact that I can, after some time, it can be, if I'm lucky, it's a day. I can have a finished painting in a day. That adventure can be, it's rare these days, you know. I don't have the stamina for that anymore, but yeah, when I first left the Papa, I could. In an hour or two, I could have finished a small painting. I could have hit the thing on the head and that was just so, like, it filled me up. I mean, that's really what got me going with my career.
Got you going and keeps you going.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the idea of not having that set idea, of going in there and having the adventure from start to finish, toward the end, really, you are mopping up, you know what I mean? It's
Well, that's the next question. How do you know when work is finished for you?
Yeah.
Because it's extraordinary to think that you're talking about creating an abstract work and somehow a representational painting comes out of it.
Yeah. Well, it's an abstract process. The process is completely abstract.
Mm.
I mean, the brushes that I use to make, you know, people think, oh, that's so detailed, you must be using really tiny brushes. Well, totally the opposite. I really look at, you know, this is what come out of house painting as well. I know how to look after these brushes so that every time I pick them up, I know that I can get these types of marks out of them. And the brushes that I use to make some of the faces or some of the things that look like a lot of detail are big. You know, there could be like 30 mil wide wedge brushes, but they're in immaculate condition, and you know,
and therefore able to extract more out of them than you might
think. Or push in and back out.
Yeah.
You know, when I'm painting, I've always got, my wife is taking photos of me working, and I've always got 10 brushes sticking out of my fingers, that each one they've got the right amount of paint, you know, the weight of paint per tips. Or just a tipsy one, or heavily, you know, pigmented, and
to really make those adjustments on the fly.
Yeah, it's all go.
Yeah. And tools, like clearly 10 brushes at least, you just mentioned.
Yeah,
but what else are you working with? So I know you said before that you'll get in there with a finger if you need to, or a rag.
Yeah.
So what are the range of tools that you're using to apply or manage paint?
You know, whatever works. If I'm charging along and it's everything is too much the same, I'll hit it with a scrubbing brush or, you know, whatever.
Whatever's in reach.
Whatever I think can make a mark that's will make a jump in the composition, lead me to somewhere else, or take what that figure is possibly doing somewhere, all of that sort of stuff. It's an open book.
Yeah. Which brings us to texture, because now I know you're not piling on impasto, you know, piles of paint, but texture is really present in the work, probably because of the range of tools you've just mentioned.
Yeah.
So are you quite cognizant of the textures you want to create as you're working in different elements of the painting?
Yeah. The texture is more like in the mark that the brush or whatever I'm using makes. It's not texture from building up layers. I never can do that. I'm too mean. I don't think I'm too mean. It's just that if I put too much on, it's too hard to work it. It's just this big gloop.
You want it to remain quite fluid.
Yeah, that's
yeah.
right.
Yeah.
I always add and subtract and add and subtract, but it's never like a shovel full.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And wanted to talk about palette as well, because it feels like there's almost a signature palette for you now. These, you know, dark, in fact, going back to twilight you mentioned,
yeah.
you know, these dark, really rich greens and blues, and every now and again, you know, there's reds and oranges. But yeah, how you seem really settled into that palette for the better, I think. How have you come to those? Yeah.
I think I used to, up until about 3-5 years ago, I was settled into that palette. But now it's expanding out, and it's getting to encompass a lot more of the colours that I was using after that portrait period. My palette is getting fuller and richer again with all colours.
That's happened through experimentation? Like, what, you know, why is it expanding at this point in career?
It's like you know, Bob Dylan, I saw an interview with Bob Dylan, and he said, you know, some of those songs I wrote when I was young were magical. I couldn't possibly do that now. The interviewer said, well, why not? You're still working. Yeah, it's different. I'm doing different things.
Yeah.
And that's what it is. I'm doing different things now. It's not like I can... falls off my brush like it used to.
So there's still that... The edge is at least of constant experimentation.
It's constant experimentation. And I'm bringing back those tricks and skills I had when I was younger and finding I'm enjoying, you know, amalgamating them with that colour range that I'm known for, you know, which is...
And those textures and almost translucent elements of work that you've talked about, especially managing the gesso kind of coming through in work.
Yeah.
There's a preference for oil paint. You always worked in oils. And why that preference?
Because the oils, even when I thin them right down, they are still pliable for a whole day. And sometimes the next morning I can still get them to move. Whereas acrylic, you know, you're shot within an hour or so. And to be able to get those, to push and pull the paint around to make the, you know, the characters and the effects that I like is too harsh. What I find I'm doing now, though, is I'm putting down a ground with acrylics. I'm creating a sort of that distant background, and then I'm able to come in across it with my oils.
Again, because that changes the nature of the surface that you're working on?
It does, and it means that the white which I was using of the ground, I can't do that. I'm having to build the paint up. And so I'm finding that as interesting, and yeah, I'm enjoying it.
The last few years you've started applying that acrylic layer.
Yeah, I've always built up the grounds with acrylic, and so to put some pigment in them was no big step.
Mm.
Yeah.
Right. And you've worked across, or you seem quite comfortable working across a mix of different supports, so board, canvas, there's paper. Is that because you...
Aluminium, I like.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
So aluminium, that's because you get a different painting with each of those different supports?
Yeah. Yeah. The aluminium... you know, gold I'm working on now. I've got a mate who's a gilding expert. He lives in Hong Kong. And he comes and visits me from time to time, and he puts down this gold, and I map out roughly where I want it to go, and then he'll put down this gold, and I'll fly in on top of that.
What on earth is gold like as a surface to work on?
It's just another one. It's just another one.
Right.
I mean, if you allow yourself to be spooked by the the value of it, you're lost. But no, it's lovely.
Yeah.
It's a very difficult, surface to paint on, in that it's the connotations and there is a lot of cliched works out there using gold, but to take it to somewhere a little bit different is a trick that I enjoy.
It's not gold leaf.
It is leaf, yeah.
Oh, it is. Right.
And plus gold dust, I'm playing with that as well, which is pretty yummy.
Final question. I'm asking everyone this.
Yeah.
So final question is, if we were to remove budget or whether a work is held in a public institution, what work would you love to live with, or, you know, what artist's work would you love to live with?
You know, I think I would sooner have all of those artists come and visit me.
Spend an afternoon.
Yeah, that's right. You know, you put up a work and you're stuck with it. I never can live with works up on the wall for too long.
Oh, you're always changing things around.
Yeah.
All right, I can't let you dodge this question then. Who do you want to spend an afternoon with then?
They might be dead.
That's okay.
Yeah.
I mean, they might be a little odorous, but...
I mean, I've always thought, you know, the Pene Taiapa and his crew who carved our whare nui and Uawa, I wouldn't mind walking into their studio or for them to come and have a boil up here one day. That would be cool. Francis Bacon would be cool. He's an amazing. But only for an afternoon.
Francis Bacon might be a bit of a handful after a while. Yeah, that's right.
You know, anyone really. I love meeting artists, no matter what their art is. Anyone who spends their time in the creative process is you know, good fodder for me.
As always, thanks for listening to this episode of The Good Oil. Your next chance to see new work from John is at Page Galleries in Wellington in July. The work I saw underway at John's studio for that show suggests it will be a typically powerful collection of paintings. Or contact Gail Langsford in Auckland, Paul Nash in Gisborne, Page Galleries in Wellington, the Division Gallery in Picton, and the Central Art Gallery in Christchurch for available work. I'd really appreciate it if you would rate, review, and share the show. That all helps people discover the podcast. Please join me for episode 9 of The Good Oil. Until then, ka kite anō.